Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Recovery from Relapse. Today's date is Tuesday, the 9th of April, 2024, and I'm absolutely delighted. An early riser this morning again. It's John Kay. John is currently living in Los Angeles. He's originally from the New York area, and he came to OA in 1981. He is now going to tell you his experience, strength, and hope. Thanks a million. John, take it away.
Oh, thank you, Marita. My name is John Kiernan. I'm a recovered compulsive overeater. Some quick numbers Rita sort of mentioned. I've been in program for 42 years, actually coming up on 43, 27, no, actually just 28 last month, years of abstinence. I've been maintaining a 105-pound weight loss for most of that time. And as those of you who can do basic math will notice, there was 42 years and then there was 28. So there was a lot of relapse going on for the first 14 years I was in program. And the thing about this relapse is I was going to 3 to 5 meetings a week. I could quote you the big book, but I still couldn't stay out of the food. Now, I don't have time for my whole story today. You can hear up on the LA podcasts if you're interested. But I really want to focus on the relapse cycle today and how to get out of it. I call it the relapse cycle because for most of us who are in the food, it wasn't just boom out and that's it. It was a week on, a week off, a month on, a month off. And it was just miserable. And let me first by saying one of my favorite sayings we have here in LA, and it's a little complicated. It's not about the food unless it's about the food. And then it's all about the food until it's not about the food. You know, what does that mean? Well, it really means first things first. You know, recovery in OA is made up of so many parts, working with a sponsor, working the steps, the big book. But in my opinion, it has to come after you put the food down. No real recovery can happen while you're still self-medicating with the food. Your disease will desperately try to tell you you could, and mine certainly did. But the reality was I got no real growth until I got the food down. A quick, super quick biography. I grew up as a fat kid, was fat all the way through high school. I tried every diet in the world. And when I first came into program, I used to say I tried every diet in the world and none of them worked. But the reality is I tried every diet and they all worked. They all worked once because I'm a good little student and you give me the syllabus, I'll follow it. But the trouble is I have the brain of a compulsive eater that immediately then starts looking for loopholes. And that's what happened. I got through high school, never dated, didn't go to the prom, hung out with all these kids who were the freak, they call them freaks and geeks that nobody else liked. And then at the end of high school, I found alcohol. And I only mention this because it's part of my story. And it was the first time I got to a normal weight. Now, this is how I did it. I would not eat for a week at a time. And then I'd binge one night, and then I would not eat for a week at a time, and I binged one night. And you know, if you're a 19, 18, 19-year-old boy with the metabolism of a hummingbird, which I would love to have now, you will lose weight, but it's not a particularly good way to do it. But the thing is, I look back now and realize, you know, there was a part of me that just knew that there was no like dimmer switch on this. There was only a dimmer. It was only an off and on switch. And the only way I could maintain any normal weight loss was to keep it off as long as I could. And that's what I did. And I ended up in my first relationship and stuff like that. But then alcohol took over. And all the weight I lost in the early days of my drinking came on and then some. You know, I always joke that I always say I was fat, then I was a drunk, and then I was a fat drunk. And again, this isn't an AA pitch, but I have to tell the one thing that was a key to being able to make a 12-step program work for me. And that's that I rebelled against any 12-step program. My mother had gone, and to me, it was this bunch of religious nuts, and I want nothing to do with you people. And I remember the thing that broke was I went to a meeting and I was desperately trying to figure a way to make it work. And I'm putting away chairs at the end of the meeting and I'm arguing with somebody about this. I'm saying, I can't be part of this religious. And he says, no, it's not a religious program. It's a spiritual program. And I said, no, it isn't. And we have the steps up. I said, look, God, 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 him with a capital H. And he looked at it and he looked back at me and said, okay, leave it out. I was like, what? He said, leave it out. You can be here till you're 120 years old. Nobody's ever going to tell you what to believe in. Nobody's going to tell you how to believe in anything. Just do us a favor. Be willing to keep an open mind. And because he said it that way, it made all the difference in the world. I got into early sobriety, but then I started doing the crazy dieting, and then I had a relapse with AA. But when I came back, by then I'd heard of OA, and I knew that was really the answer. And I came into OA, and I fell in love because all of a sudden everything made sense. And I couldn't understand why you guys have all these problems. It was an easy abstinence. I got the food plan they got, and all I have to do is follow it. And I don't know why you guys are all slipping. And it was just easy. And I also like to say this is the one time in my life I was anorexic, because I've had every iteration of this disease. I'm a compulsive eater. I'm a bulimic. I'm an exercise bulimic. And for this one little time, I was anorexic. And what happened is this. If you've been fat pretty much your whole life and you have this concept of goal weight, it almost comes with angels singing goal weight. And I thought, okay, I'm going to get to goal weight. And I had ideas. I'm going to get there. I'm going to become self-confident, like myself. I'm going to be ladies' man or whatever the hell I was thinking that. And what happened is I had a number and I got to that number and nothing changed. I didn't like myself anymore. I didn't feel any more self-confident. I was totally the same person. And so, you know, genius that I am, I said, well, it must be another 10 pounds. So I lose another 10 pounds and I don't like myself anymore. And I'm not happy and all those things. So, okay, it must be another 10 pounds. And about that time, people are looking at me like, are you okay? I was starting to look very sunken. There will be a picture going up and showing me then. And I have to say, I think it's something I had to do because if I didn't do it myself, I wouldn't understand when people say there's no number on a scale that's going to make me like myself, make me feel more confident. And it's true. There was no number on a scale. And so I did really well for a while and then I gave it away. And then I tried to get it back and it was not working. It kept being so hard. And I can look now and know something. I'm a counselor, drug and alcohol counselor, and we always talk in our business of the addict is always chasing the first high. Well, for me, I was chasing the first abstinence. I wanted it to be easy again. I wanted it to be simple. I wanted the abstinence fairy to hit me on the head with the wand, and it wasn't. Now, I can look back now and realize that first go around in OA, it was just another one of those diets, right? And I do the diets well the first time, right? And so I sort of got it together. I got married. I moved to LA. But then my program fell apart. I was slipping. It was probably the most miserable time of my life. I was going to 4 to 5 meetings a week. I remember I was secretary of this meeting and I was a sponsor. I shouldn't have been doing either of those, by the way. I had a sponsor. I was delegate to our inner group. And yet I would leave that meeting that I was secretary of and stop at the donut shop on the way home. And I remember one time walking out going, well, what am I doing? I'm not sentenced to be in OA. I don't have to be here if I don't want. But that's that pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization that I just couldn't grasp. So I'm going to jump ahead to talk about the gift of abstinence I was finally given, you know, on March 7th, you know, I remember that day. And I say a gift because I don't believe I can get abstinent. I believe I was given a gift, but I can 100% throw it away. No higher power is going to grab an abstinence from anybody, in my opinion. But so I spent a long time looking at my relapse cycle and thinking about it and doing a lot of, you know, work on it. And I found out some things that, you know, again, this is me looking backwards, 2020 hindsight, as they say. First, let me say something I don't hear at meetings enough. Recovery from food addiction is hard. I wish somebody had told me. I would hear people get up at the podium and they're trying to be all happy and, you know, and I'm hanging on by my fingernails. And I wish somebody had said, this is going to be hard, you know. And it's hard for a number of reasons that we don't have time to enumerate, other than to say some things like, unlike AA, there's a thousand easier, softer ways being thrown in your face all the time. Commercials for things and ads in various magazines. But that doesn't happen in AA. There's not a lot of, well, here's how you can drink, and even though you have a problem, it'll be okay. And then there are many others that I enumerate, like when I lead a retreat. But the most difficult with this disease is the method in which it delivers the pain. You know, with alcohol and drugs, it's acute pain. It slams you down into the sidewalk, you know, and pulls your bloody face up and goes, okay, do you get it? And if you have some ability, every once in a while, you'll go, my God, what am I doing? But with food, it's this chronic, dull pain that makes you know something's wrong. It makes you uncomfortable enough to know you should do something about it, but not always uncomfortable enough to be willing to go to any lengths, like the book says, you know? And what happens is it's such a slow, insidious thing. We start moving the goalposts. Well, I'm never going to get to 200 pounds. Okay, I'm at 200, but I'm not going to get to 220. And then you start wearing the expansive pants and you start only looking at yourself from near up. And you continually accept more and more of what was previously unacceptable. And the way I like to describe it is the story of the frog. You know, you may have heard the story, and scientists can take a live frog and bring it toward this pan of boiling water. And as the frog gets closer, he realizes this is somewhere he doesn't want to be and will thrash and try and get away. But you can take that same frog and put it in a pan of room temperature water and turn the heat up, and that frog will die in a pan of boiling water that it could have jumped out of at any time. And to me, that's compulsive eating, that slow heat rising and rising. And so it wasn't easy in the beginning. And I like to tell people this just so it doesn't, you know, not pander. For in the beginning, it is not easy. You know, maybe it will be for a little, but there's going to be times where it's going to be hard. And here's the thing, those of us with long-term abstinence, we're not masochists. If it was going to be miserably hard like it was on certain days in my first, you know, months, I wouldn't keep doing it, right? But it isn't. It's easy. It becomes so much easier. But here's the thing, to get to the place where it's easy, you got to go through the place where it's hard first. So back to looking at my relapse, I realized that I never understood powerlessness, at least as it has to do with this disease. I would go to meetings, you know, because I'm a good little student. I'd say I'm powerless, and then I'd go eat. I'd eat, powerless. Well, how powerless did I actually think I was? What was I thinking when I took that first compulsive bite? Well, what I was thinking in retrospect was, when I'm done, I will come back and I will get abstinent again. You know, why? Because I had the evidence that I could. If you've relapsed and gotten abstinent over and over, you have the proof. Well, it's the illusion of proof that you are powerful over the food. But I wasn't really abstinent. I was on a long in and out cycle, and I happened to have some ins that I deluded myself into believing were abstinence. And the way I always talk about it is, imagine I run 300 yards and I sit down, and then I get up and run another 300 yards and I sit down, and I do that for 26.2 miles. Now compare that to running a marathon, and that's what abstinence is. It's a marathon. You know, there's a great quotes at the bottom of 450, top of 451, that talks about life's always going to, you know, the tides of life flow endlessly for better or worse. I can't allow my abstinence to be dependent on what's going on in my life. It has to have a life of its own. And that's the thing I couldn't get. But again, I had this illusion of powerfulness, you know, because I knew if I broke my abstinence, I could eventually grind that train to a halt again. I might have to go to 90 meetings in 90 days, maybe get a new sponsor, do a lot of writing. But eventually I could get the food to stop again. But the moment it was, the clock was ticking on when I was going out again. And what I didn't understand about the powerlessness is I am powerful over the food in the small picture. But if you pull back, I was a film major, in the establishing shot, like they call it, I'm powerless. I just happened to have those little times where I deluded myself. So I needed to readjust my concept of powerlessness. And, you know, when I first came into programming, he's been around for a while, we used to have this sort of hardcore, we don't eat no matter what. We don't eat no matter what. Well, I heard a person just put it so much better. They said, if you're a compulsive eater and food is an option, it's always going to be the only option, you know? You know, and, you know, if you have a choice of maybe going through some emotional pain or something, and or eating something that obviously you like and that maybe does something to make you feel better or did at one point, then it's a no-brainer. So I realized for me, food could no longer be an option to pain or emotion. I can enjoy my food, but I can't. And there's a guy named Terrell here who always says, if it's not an option, it's not a problem. And so I had to understand the powerlessness. And then the other thing I had to understand was the disease. You know, I always like to say my disease is like the world's best salesman. You know, if you think of somebody who's a salesman, they're smooth and they're suave and they're friendly and they like their product, which in this case is the food. And they know you like that product, which is to eat. And that salesman is constantly, when I was trying to get abstinent, trying to make the sale 24/7, it was there. And I'll imagine it's a salesman that can also read your mind. So whatever you're going to say, he's got the answer. And that's what that salesman would do. And he would do it over and over until he made the sale and I went and broke my abstinence. But the evil thing about this salesman is when I did, he would put his arm around me and say, and by the way, this was your idea. You know, it wasn't my idea. If it was my idea, I wouldn't have been going to all those meetings. I wouldn't have been secretary, sponsor, had a sponsor. But in that moment of impulse, this is addiction at its core. That moment of impulse, it convinces me it's my idea. And it's hard because the thoughts to eat are the same as the other thoughts we have all day. Oh, I'm driving down the street. I'm going to take a left. I'm going to take a right at this next block. I'm going to pull into the store, buy a bunch of ice cream, go home and binge. Wait a minute, what was that last one? But that's just it. We can't, you know, it would be just so great if our disease sounded different. You know, if it sounded like Darth Vader, you know, John, go eat, you know, then, oh, that's my disease. But it doesn't. So I have to listen to what it says, not how it sounds. You know, and I think the most important thing I wish I had understood during my relapse is this, that salesman gets up every day with only one job to do, and that's to get me to kick the can down the road one more day on putting the food down, because it knows if it can get me to do it today, it'll get me to do it tomorrow and on and on. And that's, it's so evil. The program used all perfectly good program concepts against me. Well, I'll work on the big book. Okay, I'm not abstinent, but I'll work on the big book. Well, I'll work on the steps. You know, I'm praying for the willingness. You know, that was another one. Well, you know, willingness doesn't come from prayer. It comes from pain. It comes from desperation. But by doing that and getting me to say, well, I'm just, you know, praying for the willingness, it convinces me I'm doing something when I'm really not. I'm just going to meetings, you know, and the key to recovery is surrender, you know? And the way I talk about surrender is it's, are you out of ideas, you know? And the thing is, my disease wants to convince me of the opposite, which is negotiation. It always wants me to believe I can negotiate with this, but then my disease always wins. But here's the thing about the word surrender. It sounds like a very passive word, but it isn't. It is a very active taking back your life. You're going to be making the decisions in your life, not your disease, because that's what it did. I was like a puppet to that disease for so long. So that's how I figured out about step one. And then I needed a power greater than myself to help me with that problem. Why? Because as step two says, I'm insane. Now, I always like to reverse the order of step two and say, I'm insane, I need help. But then what? You know, and some people bristle at that word insanity, but I found the most perfect definition for insanity once. It said, a state of mind that prevents normal perception. That was it, you know? Think about, what is sanity? It's making 1,000 decisions constantly. I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. And we do a really good job because we got this great computer on the top of our shoulders that is really good at making good decisions and assessments, but it does it through our perceptions. The trouble is, I have a state of mind which prevents normal perception. And only in this one, well, two for me, two areas. And that's the thing. We have great computers, but my disease is corrupting the data that is coming in on which I am making what I think is a good decision. It's why somebody can sit at a bar and take a whiskey and put it in milk and think, oh, that won't hurt, right? In the big book, you know, Jim from More About Alcoholism. And we all laugh at that story and the absurdity of it, but you know who probably laughed too? Jim, but just not until the next day, right? I mean, how many times have we done this? What the hell was I thinking? But that's the thing. I wasn't doing the thinking. My disease was doing the thinking. And so after realizing I'm powerless and I'm reeling up, realizing I'm saying I got the problem of getting better, and the big book tells me I need a power greater than myself to help me achieve this recovery. And I always say the steps don't require belief in any kind of a formal higher power. The steps require me to believe that I am a lesser power. You know, my own best thinking got me to 300 pounds. My own best thinking got me passed out on the floor drunk. And the thing I love about 12-step programs is the concept of the levels of higher powers, as in plural. You know, it's a really grounded out God, myself, and another human being. Because when I was coming out of relapse, I needed a sponsor way more than I needed a higher power. Now, I know today my sponsor was a bridge to that higher power, but I needed help from somebody other than me. Because I can go up with the best of intentions onto a mountaintop and meditate and try and commune with God and come down convinced that chocolate is now a vegetable, you know? But then I call my sponsors and God told me chocolate's a vegetable. And my sponsor's going to be like, nah, not today. But that's just the thing. I'm a compulsive eater. I can't be sure what is the voice of my higher power versus what is the voice of my disease just doing a really good impression of my higher power. So I need that grounded out spirituality. Now, let me just speak for a minute from a person who came in with really no belief. To me, the steps are God's gift to the 20th century. You know, I always say it's the lifeboat that was sent to us for the help, but we still have to get in and row to shore. You know, I can't just sit in the rowboat and go, well, I'm powerless, you know, because there's a big difference between powerlessness and helplessness. To me, personally, this is just my personal belief. I believe in that robot, and I believe there's a thread that goes up to some kind of a higher power. But even if you don't believe in that kind of thing, just cut the thread and believe in the robot. And it doesn't even take faith, because you can look around in rooms to see people who their entire lives, they couldn't get it to work until they came to this program and worked the steps. And again, part of this, for those, anybody who's new, who's struggling with the concept of any kind of a higher power like I did, is to I had to lose my prejudice over any kind of spiritual practice. I had lumped everything together into something when it isn't, and I think we've all had that to a concept to an extent. If you think of that concept, it's why there's a chapter in the big book called We Agnostics. You know, it's not called You Agnostics, it's called We, saying, yeah, we were there with you, don't worry, you know, you'll find something, nobody's going to push it on you. But before I could come up with this conception of a higher power, I had to tear down the one I was given, because we're all given a hand-me-down God. You know, I got mine from my mother. She got it from her mother. She gets back to County Wexford, you know, but it's not our higher power. It's somebody else's higher power. And so I believe we have to tear it down and start to rebuild it. Now, we may rebuild it exactly the same way. You may find the faith of your childhood, but the thing is, then it's yours, you know? And that's so important. You know, I've been around for a long time, and I know priests, ministers, rabbis, nuns. If it was simply a matter of a conscious contact with a higher power, they would have needed to come here and get in the same rowboat we do, but they do. And for me, the concept with higher power, to me, it's all boiled down to the word only in the 11th step, praying only for knowledge of the will. In other words, it's my job to adjust to the way things are meant to be, not the other way around. The other way around got and trying to do that got me fat and drunk. So I've been able to come up with some belief in a higher power that's sort of my partner in recovery. And I always like to say it's my partner, not my servant. You know, I can't just expect it to be served up, recovery to be served up with no effort on my part. If I do my part, though, I truly believe my higher power will meet me more than halfway. And so that's it. I have to roll up my sleeves and surrender. And I always say my shorthand on the first three steps is, one, powerlessness. If you could have done this yourself, you'd have done it by now. Two, I'm crazy. I need help. And three, I need to ask for the help and take direction. You know, it doesn't mean submitting to your sponsor like they're a God, but keep an open mind. Try something new. I always say some of the stupidest things that were ever said to me were said to me by a sponsor. And what I mean by that is I would be given like some assignment by my sponsor and I'd hang up the phone and go, well, that's the stupidest damn thing I've ever heard. But I came from another program where they say bitch and moan, but do it anyway. And so I would do it. And as I was working on this assignment somewhere during it, oh my God, this is exactly what I needed to do. And thank God I didn't filter it through my broken brain. You know, there's an old saying, you can't fix a broken brain with a broken brain, right? And so I had to learn this whole concept.
5 minutes, John.
Okay, of turning it over. You know, I always had trouble with that phrase, turning it over. I think it's in the AA 12 and 12, step three, it talked about self-will. And I realized all of a sudden that the third step, I could see it like a gate opening. And gate and opening it and removing the blockage of self-will, you know? Get out of the way of life. Quit trying to swim upstream. That's what I did for so long. But I also believed, oh, if I don't, I'm going to have to get carried downstream. I mean, with no, but no, I could swim to the side and find a little eddy and consider things. So that's what worked for me, you know? And again, this program needs faith. It doesn't need faith in a higher power, but it needs faith in this process. Because so many of these things we don't understand until later. And the other thing is that a lot of this process is sort of front-loaded with pain, you know? But we do these things even though we don't understand. What do you mean? I got to write an inventory? What the hell's that got to do with eating, right? And, you know, character defects, which I hate that phrase. These were defense mechanisms for me. But I did them because people I really trust told me this is the way to freedom. And it is. But you have to have some faith in that. Let me just say a couple of other things. In the first sentence and more about alcoholism, it says no one is like admitting that they're bodily and mentally different from their fellows. And I am. I am. There's people, I have friends who can go to a restaurant, eat a, order cake and eat one piece and go, that's enough. I'm not. But here's the other thing I had to realize. This is really specific to OA. I have to realize that I am bodily and mentally different, not only from my fellows outside the room, but from ones inside this room. Some people can eat foods I can't. I can eat some foods they can't. Some people can eat all foods moderately. I wish I could. And some people need to follow a food plan with weighing and measuring, calling a sponsor. And that's what it took me so long to get. I ended up going to another program that was very strict for a while. And it worked. And they gave me what they promised me. But then after a while, that food plan and that program became an authority figure. And I came back, and they used to have a mantra. We don't eat anything except sugar-free soda, no calorie beverages, and sugar-free gum. And I came back, and there was a guy named Ray here. He's still around. He's got like 50 years of abstinence. And Ray would get up and say, my abstinence today is I eat whatever I want, whenever I want, as much as I want, if I'm willing to pay the price. And today I am not. So I eat three weighed and measured meals, nothing in between except diet soda. He says the same thing, except it's his program. It's not their program. We need to take ownership of this because my disease will convince me that abstinence is deprivation. You know, and it isn't. It'll hold up this balance sheet. Oh, look at this. You've never had a dark chocolate Reese's. You've never had Long Island iced tea. But it doesn't hold up the other side. It says, oh, look at this. You poor thing. You don't wear your pants out in the crotch because your thighs rub together. Or you no longer can run, walk up three steps and be winded or sit alone on a Saturday night. It wants to convince me. And I tell sponsees, the only one thing I say is you can't use the word can't. I can't eat sugar. I can't eat flour. Sure, you can. You can go get you all you want. It has to be something different. It has to be internal. And at the end, we're going to read the 10-step promises. And I think the goal for all of us here is spoken in the 10-step promises. And that is, we will be placed in a position of neutrality around the food. And here's the thing. It's really simple. If you want to be placed in a position of neutrality around the food, all you have to do is one thing, and that's eliminate all the foods with which you cannot be neutral, you know? So I'm running out of time, but I want to mention one last thing. For me, I'm in the mental health business, and I'm a big believer in therapy. I really needed it, because you may have something I had, which I call it an iceberg. You know, icebergs only stick out a little over the top and the rest is underground. And I needed to find out what was driving this engine of relapse. I felt like I was constantly fighting myself. I wanted to be abstinent, but I couldn't. And there's a great line. They say, if you want to find out what you're eating over, stop eating. And it was really true. I couldn't figure it out. And finally, when the food was down for a while and I'm in therapy, the answer was like this close to my nose. And that was, I was in a marriage I didn't want to be in. And it was intolerable of the fact that I had to tell that person I didn't want to be married anymore. And I couldn't deal with that. So I wheeled this big distraction between me and the real problem, which was the food. And I needed to work that out. I think a lot of people have this thing called an iceberg, you know, and you need to get it out. You know, there's a lady named Leia who started Vision for You, who always says the disease gets back in through our wounds. And that's the truth. I kept trying to stitch my wound up and it kept infecting. I needed to open that thing. I needed to clean it out. And if you know, if you've ever cleaned a wound, it hurts like heck, right? But I got told one of the most important things by a therapist, and that was, there's nothing in here that can hurt you anymore, but not dealing with it can. So if I could make one recommendation, is be willing to go to any lengths and deal with what may be in there, and it won't hurt you, I promise. Okay, I think I about hit my time. I want to just say one last thing. I'm going to put my information in the chat after we're stopped. I'm thinking of starting a meeting that's sort of focused on the first compulsive bite. And if anybody's interested, you know, shoot me an email, and I'm still formulating the whole thing. So that's it. I hope this was helped somebody, and I'll turn the meeting back over to is it Rita? I don't know who's running. Yeah, Rita.
Oh, thanks, John. John, do you want to talk through your photos quickly? I'll just show them so that you can just say, just to give people a feel for.
Oh, yeah. I didn't know if you put them up or not.
Yeah,
yes.
There you go.
There I am. Upper left is John in Blessed Sacrament in eighth grade. The one on the upper right is John at his skinniest, size 29 jeans, which I could never wear again. This is me in the middle of relapse on the lower left. And there, and that's me on the lower right at the Vision for You convention with Julie B, who I know is in London, and this other woman from British Columbia in Canada.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm just going to read out a little paragraph just to back up what John said. And it's more about alcoholism, and he actually mentioned it. Most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is a great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. We learned we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery.